Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio's Home Edition, recorded on this date, December 2nd, 2020. Well, Donald Trump has ordered a reduction in numbers of American soldiers currently in Afghanistan. This fulfills some conditions of a so-called peace deal signed with Taliban representatives in February. But peace has proven elusive, with ever more deadly attacks taking place in the country, and as ever, civilians paying the greatest price. Kathy Kelly is a longtime peace and justice activist, essayist, author, and recipient of numerous awards for her peace service, including multiple nominations for the Nobel Peace Prize. She's a founding member of Voices in the Wilderness and Voices for Creative Nonviolence, co-authored the book Prisoners on Purpose, A Peacemaker's Guide to Jails and Prison, and wrote Other Lands Have Dreams, From Baghdad to Pekin Prison. Her recent article, Like a Rocket in the Garden, The Unending War in Afghanistan, chronicles the legacy of 20 years of America's forever war in Afghanistan, an effort she describes as, quote, illegal and immoral and bankrupting our economy and our society as well. Kathy Kelly in the first half. And in early November, Victoria City Police enforced an order to tear down public showers installed by citizens concerned for the health and well-being of unhoused people living in tents in Beacon Hill Park. Pete Rockwell is a Victoria-based photographer who began recording the city's burgeoning unhoused residents in 2005. His pictures have featured in local publications like Focus on Victoria and the now defunct Victoria Street News and B Channel News Collective, among other places. Pete Rockwell's hard look at a prosperous city's people in crisis in the second half. And CFUV broadcaster and host of Plant Powered Radio, Janine Bancroft, will be here at the bottom of the hour to bring us up to speed with some of what's good going on in and around our town and virtually too in the coming week. But first, Kathy Kelly and Afghanistan at the end of America's occupation. Welcome back to the program, Kathy. Your article is a grim portrait of life in Afghanistan, and in it you write of bad news coming from some of your friends in the Afghan peace volunteers. Can we begin, Kathy, with who the Afghan peace volunteers are?
Well, thanks, Chris. You know, the Afghan peace volunteers are really an unusual group. I first met them when they were teenagers, young teenagers, you know, 11, 12 years old. And they were very idealistic. They had the idea that their futures would all be better if they could live together and work together inter-ethnically. All of them had had loss and bereavement and displacement caused by the terrible fights going on between Tajiks and Hazaras and Pashtun. And so they wanted to learn each other's languages. They wanted to prove that people could actually come together. And they also wanted to go to school in Kabul, and so they moved to Kabul with their mentor, a Singaporean doctor, an MD named Hakim. And with a very small group, they began this experiment, in a sense. But what was quite wonderful about that is that they were so small and they were so young that the predatory groups that just glom on to any larger efforts that might involve Western funding or something that people want, you know, with access or control. People had bigger fish to fry. Nobody was really trying to interfere with what these youngsters were doing. And they were steadily idealistic and almost to a fault honest. And so I see them as a microcosm of what could be in a place like Afghanistan if funds are very directly delivered, and that was, I know that's what was happening because the funds were coming from colleagues of mine and groups we knew, and we would just travel over there and say, here, this is the support that people in the United States and the United Kingdom and Ireland and Canada and others want to give you. And then we watch them, you know, trot right off to the bank and deposit it and then start these very desperately needed projects to have widows create heavy blankets and be paid a meager wage. And then they would, these kids, organize the distribution of the blankets for free at refugee camps. And then they, it took a couple of years, but they finally figured out how to start up a street kids school. And the kids who came got rations for their families that would last for the month. And so these very good projects made them feel like they were responsible. They could take responsibility for making things better. And it made people in the United States at least, feel like, you know, we've been responsible for making things really bad, but we can sort of pay reparations. And this was done without any involvement of anybody's government.
Well, did they get to it? Oh, sorry, Kathy.
Well, I just am not despairing, because I think things can happen. We just have to approach them in a very different way.
I mean, is there a danger they will grow to a size that will attract these kinds of predators that you describe? And is that what's happened? Or are they still managing as they become, you know, both more well-known and more widespread in their efforts?
Well, you know, so much is changing right now, even as we speak. I don't know the answer to that. Young people their age are actually being targeted by various Talib groups. You know, there's not the Taliban. There's Chinese Talib and Pakistani Talib and Talib serving the interests of India and all kinds of different mafiosas and warlords. And so, you know, if somebody becomes known as an effective organizer and they're in their 20s, that's much different from being a 13-year-old. They could be at risk. And yes, they have grown. They've had a center. It's in a very out-of-the-way area of Kabul. It's hard for people to find it, but it's been a place where 50 kids on any given day would tend to be gathered, and they're young men and young women, and Talib groups sometimes have, you know, their eyebrows raised just about that, not to mention the effort to bring together Hazara and Tajik and Pashto people. One reality is that their funding has pretty well taken a big dive, which would make predators even less interested in them, because we can't get over there, both with the COVID restrictions, and we all do have to really ask ourselves about the wisdom of fostering international travel in a time of climate catastrophe. So they're experiencing considerable changes. One thing I would mention, though, is that a group called the Jesuit Refugee Services, JRS, has also, concurrent with them, kind of figured out how to get its feet on the ground in Kabul. And their service is directly toward refugees, of whom, of course, there are many, many, many in Kabul, people who had to flee from war, or, you know, there wasn't any water coming up out of the well any longer, or they had become widows or orphans. So there are refugee camps just teeming, and there are still soaring populations. And the JRS looks out now for the food needs of 330 families. And I've been to the classes that they operate, and, you know, they did practical things, and just trying to at least create one small walled-off or gated-off space that would be for the classes, not for anything else, and so it wouldn't get trashed or ruined. It's, you know, there's a lock on the gate. And they did a hydraulic pump that, you know, sometimes doesn't work, but when it does, it's a great, great service. So, you know, there are some smaller organizations that are doing great things and could use volunteers as well.
Well, it was a scandal here in Canada. Of course, Canada was involved in the destruction of Afghanistan starting in 2001, but there was millions of tax dollars directed towards building schools in Afghanistan, and it was the thing that the government, or successive governments, held up to say, well, yes, we've done terrible things here, terrible things are going on still, but look what we're creating, and this is a promising future, especially for the young girls of Afghanistan. And it turned out that those schools, when they were built at all, many were never occupied, some were destroyed, and a lot of the money just disappeared altogether.
Now, the fraud and the waste and the corruption has been stunning. There's something called the Special Inspector General on Afghanistan report that comes out 4 times a year in the United States. And, you know, a copy is put on the desk of every single senator and congressperson. But, you know, I don't know if they use them as you know, door jams or footstools or what. But the guy in charge, his name is John Sopko, at one point wrote that he personally was astonished by the level of hubris and mendacity and distortion and lies present in the United States military and the civilian presence in Afghanistan, as well as the Afghan military and civilian presence. So that does not bode well for government oversight. You know, the United States was so clear, we're going to overcome corruption. We're going to overcome the drug trafficking. We're going to set up a safer setting in Kabul without any terrorism. Well, you know, every single point that they claimed justified the United States militarism has been an utter failure. But with that said, it doesn't lessen the responsibility that people have if they've been involved in any way in waging war in Afghanistan to clean up the weapons that they've strewn all over the country, especially landmines, to set up a multinational fund that would be a trust fund, more or less, that could be drawn from to hopefully collect money commensurate to what was spent on the war, and that would be billions of dollars, and make sure that the oversight of that trust fund has nothing to do with Western nations or any of the organizations that have proven themselves vulnerable to so much corruption and fraud. And then I think there should be some kind of peacekeeping presence set up, but I wouldn't recommend that it involve armored personnel carriers and tanks and weaponry. I don't think it should even involve any of the NATO countries. So we need to press for these kinds of different approaches, because what's been done clearly has not been anything that bettered the lives of anyone in Afghanistan, or I think anyone who was involved in going to Afghanistan sent by their government.
I always struggle to understand how people could be surprised. I'm rereading The Confessions of an Economic Hitman. It's actually a new release. Just rereading it reiterates to me it's not just the governments, but there's this nexus of governments and corporations, Bechtel Corporation and other, you know, huge engineering firms and resource companies and so on. This is a ploy, a game there, where they can't get in to build the infrastructure to control governments. They go and control or destroy those countries to get that control.
Now, there's a very fine professor. His name is Zahar Wahab, and he spent the previous 6 years living in Afghanistan, teaching at the Afghan University of Kabul. I'm sorry, the American University of Kabul. And then felt that it just wasn't sensible to try and stay in Kabul anymore, that the city has become unlivable. But he adds into the governmental corrupt activity going on in and the proxy wars being waged, the mafia-like organizations running the drug trade, running control over valuable minerals and ores, control even over water, control over access to foreign aid. There are really mafia-like groups that are very ruthless and very dangerous, and people just get caught. They're trapped in the middle of all of the warring parties, the mafioso-like groups, and in a way, the men have a better chance to make a run for it if they have to escape. A man can hide or run in ways that women with children often can't, so the women are doubly trapped.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Kathy Kelly. Kathy is a longtime peace and justice activist, essayist, author, recipient of numerous awards for her peace service, including multiple nominations for the Nobel Peace Prize. She's a founding member of Voices in the Wilderness and Voices for Creative Nonviolence. We've got to talk about that before we're finished. And she collaborated on the book Prisoners on Purpose, A Peacemaker's Guide to Jails and Prison, and wrote Other Lands Have Dreams, From Baghdad to Pekin Prison. We're talking, ostensibly, we haven't yet, but we will. Kathy, your recent article, Like a Rocket in the Garden, The Unending War in Afghanistan, and that can be found at voicesforcreativenonviolence.org, vcnv.org. Kathy, you begin your article talking about getting very bad news from Afghanistan. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, initially we had heard that a rocket attack launched by some insurgent group inside Kabul had hit the family home of Fereshta Ahmadi. Now, later, it turned out that, in fact, these were extended family relatives, and Fereshta was spared, and her family, her immediate family, was okay. But, of course, this is the kind of fear that the kids are living with, and this on the heels of the university having been attacked, and 22 students were killed, and a a tutoring center to help kids prepare to get into university, which mainly served Hazara Shia Afghans, was attacked. And these kinds of attacks on young people are very, very frightening. And the street crime is terrible. And people find that prices are going up under COVID. You know, people don't have access even to more than just bread and maybe enough money to buy wood for fuel in these harsh winter days. It's a very, very difficult situation. And one of the stories that really stayed in my mind came from the New York Times correspondent, who sadly is now leaving Afghanistan to work in India, but his name is Mujib Mashal. And he remembers being a little boy growing up in Kabul, and a civil war was going on between various Mujahideen and Taliban, and rockets were flying, and a rocket hit their garden, his father's vegetable garden. And the rocket cut an apple tree in half and then went under the ground. And he remembers his father would water the space where he thought the rocket must be regularly in hopes that it would cause the rocket to rust and it wouldn't explode. And, you know, I think in some ways we in the United States, and to some extent Canada too, we've placed a rocket in our own garden by making ourselves more vulnerable to the military-industrial contractors, the big corporations that, you know, they need wars in order to make profits.
What a metaphor that is. You're faced with this dilemma. What do I do with it? If this goes off as I'm moving it, I'm no expert. It'll blow up my house, maybe kill me and my neighbors. But then you're faced with leaving it there. This idea that you have this untended threat that is forever left just sitting there, never knowing what's going to happen next.
Well, I think that's a big question, the idea of education. And it worked to the benefit of the United States government and the war makers to have people so tuned into sports and entertainment that they, you know, wouldn't really have time to pay attention to important things because they had to watch that football game or watch that award-winning show. And now with COVID, you know, I really thought, whoa, you know, the sports and the entertainment nexus is kind of taking a dive. Maybe people will become more thoughtful and attentive. But then we had the United States elections and the mismanagement of COVID, and that's drawn a lot of attention. But I don't see any hint that the attentiveness that foreign policy requires in a time of perpetual wars, forever wars, is becoming, you know, of interest to people. You know, I just had a talk with a friend of mine who did a plowshares action at a nuclear weapon facility, and she's getting ready to go to prison. And I said, you know, Martha, the last time I was in prison in 2016 for crossing the line at a military base that was waging drone warfare against Afghanistan, I did a three-month prison stint. So it was interesting to me that although in the men's prisons, apparently they have to have a special room for each of the news stations. There's so much interest in TV news reports on a daily basis. The women really were much more interested in their kids and in dramas and soap operas, in a sense. They didn't know, I couldn't find anybody that wanted to tune into, quote, the news. And so that was an odd time in my life to be as cut off as I was from news. So I wonder, is there a possibility that the switch can flip? You know, and if people in the United States might really and truly become interested in and caring about the wars that have been waged presidency after presidency and actually do have a very deleterious effect on average U.S. people. But I'm not sure. We need a lot more energy coming from the mainstream newsmaking groups.
I have to admit, Kathy, I watch football, and it's interesting to me to see these phony crowds with phony crowd noises. I mean, you talk about fake news. Now it's fake sport. It's like we've entered a false or maybe we're just seeing for the first time the falsity of the things that that attract our attention, without getting too philosophical about it. But Kathy, now you write about the Trump peace proposal or peace deal with the Taliban, and as you said before, there isn't a Taliban. There's many different varieties, many different powers, and you describe it chillingly, as well as saying that there's insurgent groups, U.S. forces, Afghan government forces, NATO forces, various powerful Afghan warlords, paramilitaries organized by ruthless mafias, and these are all fighting against each other, and the military contractors from outside the country brought in that outnumber and have for a very long time the actual American soldiers there. There's a new administration coming in. What hope do you have that the Biden administration will stay on the course of pulling American troops and their contractors out, and should they?
Well, I think there is a possibility that they'll stay with the pullout of the troops, but I doubt that they'll pull out the special operations forces and many of the contractors. They're not going to want to lose that launching pad, in a sense. You know, Afghanistan's geography is sort of a problem for it, because they're right there next to Iran, next to China, next to or close to Iraq. And I think that the United States is still in so much competition with Russia, with China, with Iran, that it's not going to want to lose that particular launching pad. And Biden has said he favors special operations forces. Well, that doesn't augur well. I mean, the special operations groups have botched raids in a succession, and they're stunning stories about getting it wrong. And sometimes they're horrible stories about torture and murder. So, you know, it doesn't seem implausible to me that the Taliban could pretty quickly say, you know what, we're nullifying that agreement. And it never was a peace agreement. It was a troop withdrawal agreement. It wasn't anything to do with what would create peace in Afghanistan. So I think the Biden administration certainly has big problems on its hands. But if it could recognize that it's the United States that caused the proliferation of these paveway laser-guided missiles in the region. It's the United States that caused proliferation of drone attacks and drone surveillance. And so if other countries are now starting to practice what the United States started, why continue to punish ordinary people in Afghanistan or ordinary people in Iran? I think the United States and Israel and all of the countries that have pressed forward with these hideous weapon systems should get together and say, you know what, we've got bigger problems on our hands to solve. We've got climate catastrophe. We've got pandemics. We've got enormous refugee populations. So what do you say we work together and solve those problems and stop proliferating these weapon systems, which we're now afraid other smaller countries are going to get and aim at us. You know, if they could get a grip and level with one another and then with the publics in their own countries, this could make a difference. But you don't hear hardly a hint of it. Instead, you just get the same tired out, old. We have to be in competition. We have to be ahead of to get better weapons. We have to eliminate their weapons. We have to put sanctions on Iran because they might get weapons like what we've been using against everybody else. It's not a way forward.
Well, in Australia right now, of course, they're hearing a lot about what their soldiers have done in Afghanistan, and Canada was embroiled some years back in a similar scandal. The Afghan war logs put out by WikiLeaks, 10-year anniversary was marked. Can you briefly, Kathy, give me a comment on continued prisoner of conscience, political prisoner, Julian Assange?
Well, he should certainly be thanked for having alerted the world to just how vicious the U.S. forces were being, and both in Iraq and Afghanistan. And instead, he's been punished horribly. And, you know, we keep hoping maybe there'll be a pardon, or perhaps there would be some willingness on the part of the United States to stop demanding extradition. But he has already been over punished horribly. Again, that's not a story you'll find in the mainstream news.
Yeah, it's pretty dispiriting, and perhaps not totally dispiriting. Voices for Creative Nonviolence, you guys have a notice out that you're saying goodbye. What's that about?
Well, we don't want it to be a firm, total goodbye change. We needed some resilience because, you know, the truth is we've said for a long time that we would live alongside people in war zones who didn't have a chance to escape. And I think we, you know, made good on that commitment. But we aren't able to travel now in a time of pandemic. And as I mentioned, you know, given climate catastrophe, we're not even sure that international travel is a good idea. And we're a small group. It's not so difficult for us to reconstitute. We can make sure that anything that's ever been given to us, entrusted to us for other people, goes to other people. We've never taken salaries or tried to make a profit in any stretch of the imagination. But I think we'll be a different collective. We're thinking about maybe calling ourselves To End All Wars, a group called To End All Wars. So we'll still be there. I sure have a debt of gratitude, stretching all the way back to when people helped us do Voices in the Wilderness and travel to break the economic sanctions against Iraq. And I think we still have a big responsibility to bring these issues before the courts, and that sometimes is through civil disobedience, before the legislators, and before the executive of our own government and other governments. And so we are kind of making it up as we go along, but we don't see ourselves having any less responsibility or energy to try to end all wars.
Yeah, what a long road it's been. And yeah, as you say, I don't see the end of it. And then there's Yemen. But sadly, Kathy, there's always way more topic than there is time. I thank you again for all your work and for coming on again today. And I look forward to our next conversation, because I know, as you say, there will be more. I want everyone else to stay tuned for Janine. She's coming up with this week's Left Coast Events Bulletin. So stay tuned for that. Thanks again, Kathy, for coming on.
Thank
and again
you,
for all your work.
Wonderful to be with you.
All right, then.
Today, Thursday, December 3rd, MST Futurism, Decolonizing the City Through a Matriarchal Lens. MST is the Squamish Nation, the Musqueam Nation, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations, and speaking about their visions for the future of what is currently known as Vancouver. MST people have lived in these lands since time immemorial. We have never ceded or surrendered title to our lands. They say rights to our resources or authority to make decisions within our territory. So this is a chance to hear from leaders from these nations and some of the visions that they hold for the future. On December 4th, Friday, Disability Foundation's Accessible Community Forum about transportation in BC. Do you feel you have equal access to public and private transportation services in British Columbia? This is presented by the Disability Foundation in partnership with Lyft Ride Sharing and the Connect Trust Society. It'll be an online forum bringing organizations together to learn from the disability community about barriers in getting around. They have a survey online. Go to disabilityfoundation.org for that, and then you can participate in this forum Friday at 1. There's a webinar on Friday, December 4th, starting at 11, AFRICOM and Human Rights in Africa. So the U.S. military established AFRICOM on October 1st, 2008, claiming that combat operations in Africa are to counter violent extremist organizations, which they say are finding safe haven throughout our African countries. So we're unfolding the truth of what the U.S. is really all about. More and more, it seems, this is an opportunity to learn more about this from the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and World Beyond War and Black Alliance for Peace. So that's online, AFRICOM and Human Rights in Africa. Saturday, the Dog Wab, which was postponed, it was scheduled previously, the Day of Giving Within Arbitrary Borders, are going to try and go ahead with this on Saturday, December 5th. Is an opportunity to give to marginalized groups and people in the form especially of personalized items, razors, combs, undergarments, socks, toothpaste, toothbrushes, gloves, hats and scarves, soap, that sort of thing. And so they're still collecting. You can go online if you have anything to contribute, including cash. Saturday, December 5th, 4:30, they'll be out in the downtown east side helping the folks there. And it's all plant-based food offerings as well. Indigenous Solidarity Zoom fundraiser on December 5th, Saturday, from 1 till 3, a fundraiser for Raven Trust with support for Indigenous land defenders who have been taken advantage of by the federal and provincial government, who are forcing energy projects onto territories without consent. So Raven Trust supports them, and you can support Raven Trust at a fun fundraiser with musicians and visual artists and speakers online. Indigenous Solidarity Zoom fundraiser on Saturday. On Sunday, the threat to Al-Quds, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, we know the city as Jerusalem, and this is a very big event with lots of support from lots of organizations. It's a look at what's going on in the region, and in particularly with regard to settlements, expansion, and that sort of thing. So check it out online. It's hosted by Just Peace Advocates, Canadian Friends Service Committee, and 11 other groups. Sunday also, it's the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women commemorative event, 31 years since the École Polytechnique massacre in Montreal. So there's a couple of events I found. One is hosted by the Alberta Federation of Labour. It starts at noon till 1, and they will be online and accepting donations for women's shelters and supporting Indigenous women and on reserve shelters. And then also in the evening, 5 till 5:40 on Sunday, hosted by the Public Service Alliance of Canada in the BC region, and again collecting donations for local women's organizations. On Wednesday, Conflict Transformation Seminar, hosted by Indigenous Perspective Society. 3-hour seminar examines different types of conflict, providing insight into how we can navigate it and see it as an opportunity for necessary transformation. It's hosted by Indigenous Perspective Society. You can find more information from them, or the event is on Facebook Wednesday at 1:30, December 9th. And then finally, Chris, all month started December 1st to December 31st, 31 Days of Liberation Activism Challenge, hosted by DXC, Direct Action Everywhere. So they have certain guidelines. They'd ask you to check those out and then participate in a peaceful, nonviolent way to take action for animals every day, even during a pandemic. The first thing we can do is become vegan. Once we're vegan, we can become activists for the animals, all animals, everywhere. And there's lots of different ways that we can do that. So dxc.io/31days, you can get more information, and they've got a bingo card you can complete throughout the month of December. That's what I found for this week.
There is no dream
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio's Home Edition, recorded on this date, November 30th, 2020. Well, in early November, Victoria City Police enforced an order to tear down public showers installed by citizens concerned for the health and well-being of unhoused people living in tents in Beacon Hill Park. While not supporting the DIY action, Progressive Victoria Councillor Jeremy Loveday acknowledged, quote, "There has been a failure to provide basic services to some of our most vulnerable residents, and that includes the provision of showers and other hygiene services." Well, that failure is not the city's alone, though even as millions lose jobs and housing becomes ever more precarious, little is being done to address the structural inequity of an economic system that routinely tosses Canadians to the curb. Pete Rockwell is a Victoria-based photographer who began recording the city's burgeoning unhoused residents in 2005. His pictures have featured in local publications like Focus on Victoria and the now defunct Victoria Street News and B Channel News Collective, among other places. Pete Rockwell's hard look at a prosperous city's people in crisis. Welcome to the program, Pete.
Good to be on.
Well, it's my great pleasure to have you, of course. Now, Pete, in the description accompanying your pictures of the city's Beacon Hill shower removal operation, you write, quote, "You'd think the convergence of a virus pandemic, spiraling drug overdose deaths, and increasing homelessness would be considered an emergency. Apparently not in Beacon Hill Park." Well, Pete, for those unaware of the story, what's the situation down there?
Beacon Hill Park was sort of the a much later chapter in an earlier story, which is that Victoria woke up to the reality that COVID-19 is a pandemic. I don't want to put words in their mouths, so this is my take on their thinking. It seemed to me that the city finally sort of woke up and says, "Well, there's if we let the homeless people just kind of go any old place, you know, they're going to get sick and then we might get it." So it took a pandemic for them to come up with the tent city that was organized in Topaz Park. And that went on for a while. Then I guess I don't know exactly what fell apart there. I guess there were some disaster stories. The neighbors didn't like it. So the complaint from the street was that it was almost like being in a prisoner of war camp or something. It had so many regulations. Certain promises weren't kept. So they decided to empty Topaz Park, they being the city, and they came up with putting people in hotels, and they started buying hotels and trying to rent hotel rooms and so on. And then there was the ever reappearing list, capital L, that always shows up at all the tent cities. And it's mysterious, and nobody knows who runs it, and nobody knows who to go get, how to get on it. And people are told that, yes, you're on the list. And the list is the entryway into even temporary housing in a motel room. So the ones that didn't get housed through that process, the city said, okay, if you go, this is a pandemic, and if you go to Beacon Hill Park, we will suspend the bylaws there and we'll leave you alone. So a number of people went there. And the numbers have increased, I guess. Well, the numbers have gone up and down. So it's 30 people, it's 100 people, it's 80 people, it's 130 people, and so on. But the ones that are there now, which are very roughly estimated at 100, have been there for a while, at the mercy of the police and the bylaw officers, who are sometimes quite nice. And sometimes, I mean, they're theoretically enforcing policies made by the city. Now, while we have that, we also have people that do live in houses and are concerned about the health and well-being of homeless people sitting in a park and living in a park during a pandemic. And they've come up with various things, as you read in the introduction, where one group actually decided that there's no showers available for these people, and that's not healthy. It's not even, according to the United Nations, it's a human right to be able to clean yourself and have water at least. So they took it upon themselves and raised money and built these two showers and brought it in. And they were going to put it on the edge of the big sandy soccer field. And they did bring it. But that morning, the city came and dug up all the, because that was one of the, that was the only place where there was water available. Water that had been used for drinking water and for washing, hand washing for these, all these weeks. And so then the city comes and tears up the pipes and there's no water available. So then after a few days, the people that built and installed the showers came and took them away so they didn't get trashed by bylaw officers picking up their showers and putting them in a dumpster or putting them in a dump truck and dumping them somewhere. Then the showers reappeared on the parking lot off of Circle Drive in the middle of the park. And I there's a posting of mine on Flickr that actually a video tour of the showers, and there's, you know, it had hot water and they were, they'd made a dressing room and they made a little room for food and essentials. And then another group in the meantime had put together what they called, somebody had bought a kind of a garage size tent, and they called it the community tent. And they filled it with donated food and blankets and essentials and tools and different things, all again at their own expense. And the city can't stand that, so they send 30 cops supporting, I don't know how many bylaw guys in uniforms. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference because uniforms are similar. And they block the whole area off. And they tear down the tent and throw it in the dump truck, confiscate the showers. I don't know if they destroyed the showers or not. It seems to me I've heard they claim they're keeping them in storage. I guess my feeling is that instead of it doing things like that, which seem pretty heavy-handed and seem kind of Soviet-ish or fascist, you know, why aren't they providing more showers? I mean, even behind the courthouse in that tent city, they finally came up with a portable whole shower unit that was clean, had hot water, and it may have even had some laundry facilities. I can't remember. But why didn't the city come up with that? Instead, like, this whole deal is that homeless people are somehow separate from all the rest of us. They are not us. They are other. And they're not only other, they're criminal other. Why else would they send in the police if this wasn't a crime that was going on? And it just boggles my mind. I mean, it seems to me it'd be cheaper in the long run and better for all of us if the city said, okay, we're your brothers, we're your ally. What do you need? Let's work together and actually provide some of this stuff. And then when the pandemic's over, we'll figure out more long-term solutions for homelessness. This is all done in the context of neoliberal capitalist worldwide economic policies.
For those that aren't aware of this issue didn't begin with COVID. And you mentioned that the courthouse in 2016, there was an encampment built in the back of the provincial courthouse, and it fell between legal cracks where the city couldn't get rid of it as much as they tried. It was a much more conservative city governance at that time. But when you mentioned that there is a provision, there is an expectation that is international, the United Nations Protocol for Homeless Encampments in Canada states that, quote, the denial of access to water and sanitation by governments constitutes cruel and inhumane treatment and is prohibited under international human rights law. And I wonder, you know, Pete, when you say that these citizens are considered to be other, to be foreign in some way and criminal to boot, there are laws that they are in contravention of bylaws and such, building showers. But the city, when given the opportunity to provide showering services at Royal Athletic Park, a city-owned facility that is sitting empty at the moment, they begged off and said, well, we can't find an agency to run it. The city was not going to run the showers, and they needed somebody to oversee it. This, according to Emily Fagan, a writer at the Tyee.ca. What about the responsibility? We've got this city council that is supposed to be so progressive and inclusive, and yet the city refuses to provide this access to facilities as mandated in the United Nations Declaration.
Well, there's 2 points I would like to make. One is somewhere down the line, all of a sudden, Lisa Helps starts talking about her. They're almost like their hands are tied because there's the Beacon Hill Park blah, blah administration thing that came into being in the 1880s or 90s. You know, clearly they have the power to supersede all that because they did that originally by saying, go ahead and stay in Beacon Hill Park. So they superseded every bylaw that's on the book for Beacon Hill Park by saying that. And that did happen. And then what was the other thing that you asked?
The provision of using Royal Athletic Park, or perhaps even the Crystal Pool, both that are sitting empty that have extensive facilities, by saying that they don't have a third party to operate it.
Well, here's another thing that, I mean, somehow COVID just is dropped out of the conversation at a point when it's getting worse, not better. And the other point is they just can't stand it if homeless people themselves and people that ally themselves with homeless with people in an attempt to make their life better, they can't stand it for those people to actually solve problems on their own. So they crushed Chrissy Brett's park out by Uptown. All the attempts that were made by the people that live there and the people that came to, you know, the Chrissy Brett types, they can't stand it. They can't somehow, you know, whatever happens has to be totally supervised and bylawized by city government on up. And my view on that is just, it's a paradigm problem, you know? I mean, I don't know why they can't just get off it and say, and meet with the people that are trying to organize communities in these parks and say, we're equals and we'll have a meeting and let's figure out what to do together. But no, they can't do that. They can't bring them, you know, the Cynthia Diedicks of the world wouldn't stand for it. You know, she being the author of a very shamelessly terrible petition to send in the police and get rid of the campers.
There are the Downtown Victoria Residents Association as well are concerned. They're raising issues. There's always an idea of control that if people are allowed to set up camps and tents wherever they like and run outside of the parameters of the city bylaws, they are by definition outlaws. We don't know what they're going to do. They don't have anything to lose. And maybe crime's going to go up in my neighborhood. People are breaking into my cars or whatever. So people are afraid. I would posit, and that fear prompts hatred and calls to authorities to do something about this.
Well, instead of, as Donald Trump did for 4 years, fanning the flames of fear, you know, one of government's job is to calm fears when there's emergencies. And if they saw this as an emergency, as I do, because it's the confluence of an epidemic, of a drug overdose epidemic, and increasing numbers of homeless people due to the economy and to the just, you know, criminally high rents, as I say, it requires a kind of shift in thinking. But I think that's what's necessary. I mean, what I've tried to do in my photography was very simple. I've taken portraits of people that live in tent cities and in Beacon Hill Park specifically at the moment. And just so you can look and see that here's an individual. Here's this one older one. Here's a younger one. Here's a man. Here's a woman. Here's a indigenous person. And some of them have consented to be recorded, their thoughts and things. And they have very, you know, each has their own way of seeing the world. And, you know, there are just like us that have houses, except, I mean, people, it's not like drug addiction is limited to people that live in parks. It's out there in the world. In fact, most of the fentanyl deaths and opioid deaths are happening in houses, mm-hmm. in people's houses.
Yeah, this is something that it does. I guess it's not okay. It's not as newsworthy when 60% of the fentanyl deaths are actually weekend warriors and people that don't live on the streets but that are ODing at home, and oftentimes through doctor's prescription medicine and not something they got in the street necessarily. You know, you right. see in accompanying your pictures of the Beacon Hill Park, you write under your pictures, you say, if this was an earthquake or a flood, the C-130s and first responders would have shown up months ago. But no, in Victoria, this is not an emergency. This is a crime. So send in the police, send in the bylaw enforcers, and destroy the efforts to make some unbearable lives a little more bearable. And it gets back to the point, Pete, that we treat these citizens as extant from the polity, that they are somehow other. They're an embarrassment that can't be born, can't be regarded by the good burghers of the city. They can't be abided.
Yeah, they treat them as subhuman. I mean, just my language of saying them, instead of my brothers and sisters down there who need help. That's where I'd like my tax dollars to go. I just spent $3,000 on property taxes. So instead of stainless steel railings on the breakwater, I'd rather see some help for some forward motion on homelessness.
Don't get me started on the breakwater, Pete. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Pete Rockwell. Pete's a Victoria-based photographer. He began recording the city's burgeoning unhoused residents in 2005. His pictures have featured in local publications like Focus and the defunct Victoria Street News and B-Channel News Collective as well. Pete, you want to tell me, why did you get into photography in the first place? You've been doing this for 15 years. Lots of people have photography as a hobby, and they take pictures, as you describe, of puppy dogs and flowers and stuff. But you decided to go to some of the hardest places in our city and around here as well. Why did you choose to go in that direction with your photography, Pete?
It was actually a couple of coincidences. My son was going to Emily Carr Art School, and he specialized in photography. And so I'd go over and visit with him and wander around the school and kind of marvel at all the photographic stuff he had access to, and we'd go to see exhibits. Fred Herzog Bertinsky come to mind, and I was just blown away by both of them. Okay, so that happened, and then so I was helping him go through school, at least partially, and I thought it'd be a good opportunity, kind of a talk once a week. So what did we learn in school this week, Neil? So I learned a lot about photography from him and just about the technical aspects of it. And I still do. I still phone him up when I have technical problems. And then the other thing was when I turned 60, I had a heart attack and managed to live through that. And the heart doctors at one point said, you must walk. You must walk 2 miles a day. And I thought, geez, okay. So I drew a circle, a 1 mile circle from my house on the map, and I could go all different directions and out and back, and that would be 2 miles. And then early on, I started bringing a camera along, which I guess sort of defeated the exercise purposes of it, but nevertheless. So I was walking by Cridge Park one day, and I noticed there were tents in there and a bunch of people. It was just about this time of year, so it was getting colder and damper, and they had a fire going in a 50-gallon oil drum. I said to myself, a real photographer would go in there and take pictures just to have something. Like, photographs should mean things, and so you can take pretty pictures and put them on Instagram and wherever. And some of them are very good. I don't have anything against doing that, really. But it doesn't hold my interest. I want to be learning about a part of the world I don't know anything about through photography, if I'm going to do photography. So I've always kind of sided with the underdog throughout my life, and I've always been sort of art oriented. my dream would be to do socially relevant photography as art, that actually you did something. I guess that would be my answer.
It's not only the street photography that you're doing here in Victoria, but you've also done industrial photography, and you've gone up. I was looking at your Flickr page, and you have pictures of a trip you took up the Thompson. I'm assuming you were on your way up to the roadblocks up in the north for what used to be called Enbridge.
Yeah, it's the same project. Yeah, whatever they call it these days. Yeah, I wish I'd photographed that more. I was sort of, because there's a lot of it around. But the other thing is, you're driving 60 miles an hour. It's not always easy to just stop and take pictures. And so I was, like, the river itself has always fascinated me. Bertinsky, you know, some of the cliff shots along the early part of the Thompson, those were Bertinsky's first shots, his railroad cut pictures. So there's a kind of connection to photo history there. And I've always been fascinated by the effects of the Coquihalla Highway, which it seems to have killed the motel business all along Highway 1. There's a number of abandoned hotels, and I like taking pictures of abandoned things, and especially abandoned things that have been kind of forced into abandonment through ineffable market forces. You know, once again, our culture allows the abstractions of market forces to affect and determine real things. And so that fascinates me.
I see a connecting line here, Pete, between your abandoned people and your abandoned motels and abandoned factories and mill towns.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've also taken pictures of clear cuts. And again, we have ineffable market forces determining, and a hunger for profit. You know, everything has to make a profit or it isn't worthwhile. But time is money. The whole idea of time is money is a very destructive idea. I mean, time clearly isn't money unless you let it be or make it be.
Well, we're fast running out of time, Pete, in more ways than one, I think. How do people access your work? How do they find your work, and how do they perhaps support you in it?
I haven't really figured that out very well. I'm better at going out. My energy goes into going out and taking pictures and then printing some of them. As far as promoting myself and promoting pictures and all that, at the moment, the only way they can go is if they Google Flickr Pete Rockwell, then there should be two Flickr sites that come up, and then that's pretty much what's available online. There's a guy at Beacon Hill Park, his name is Shea Smith, and he's tried in various ways to organize the people that live there into some sort of a political force, which was pretty hard to do. But he's had a Twitter page thing called Humans of Meegan, M-E-E-G-I-N, which is the indigenous name for what we call Beacon Hill Park. And it's rough. He does it all with his broken, barely together cell phone. And he has people that come to his tent and they have conversations, podcasts, and so if you want to have a somewhat raw view of what it's like to be in there and what the people are like in there, people should give it a listen.
Can you repeat the handle, the podcast?
It's called Humans of Meegan. It's on Twitter. M E E G A N.
Well, thanks a lot, Pete, for coming on today and talking a little bit about your work.
I enjoyed it.
I also want to thank Janine Bancroft and Kathy Kelly and all the good folks that keep the wheels spinning week in and week out. That's all I've got for this week, but there's great programming coming up. You know that. Until the next time.